Today is February 7th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with, well, essentially the same program. However, WBAI is in a membership drive tonight and the programs are different. Headline news during the past week. When is a telephone call not a telephone call? Windows Defender to start removing scareware. Microsoft Office 2019 will only work on Windows 10. Microsoft ditches Windows 10S in favor of NS mode. Cell phone radiation poses no real harm to humans. Unlimited wireless data is here to stay, so you better check your options. Apple properly fixes the 123 calculator bug in iOS. Best Buy is pulling their CDs from their stores. And Google Fiber Wireless dropped internet service in Boston. So let's get on with the show and let's get to the news. Cord cutting has hit a speed bump. When we talk about cord cutting, we are referring to the cost of personal communications. There is the internet service, subscription to cable or satellite television channels, the cell phone with a probable data plan, and the home land telephone line together costing an average of about $300 a month. This totals the average household expense of $3,000 to $4,000 a year. 39.4% of households today had both a wireless phone and a landline. Today, 6.5% of homes are landline only, while 3.2% remain phone-free. The figures based on a telephone poll of nearly 20,000 households show just how quickly Americans have abandoned landlines. Most U.S. homes no longer use landline phone service and instead rely on cell phones to stay connected. The finding was released today by the U.S. Health Department, which said that 50.8% of American households were now wireless only when it comes to phone service. Landline service are, for the most part, unlimited minutes for 24/7, covering 50 states in the United States. As always, we say the devil is in the details. I've been using the landline for a weekly telephone conference meeting. This week, while signing into the meeting, I kept getting the starting message that the domestic line, which is located in North Dakota, has a charge for minutes used. The message further explained the telephone number is out of plan. Wait a minute. North Dakota is part of the United States. AT&T Singular has begun blocking access to a free conference calling service, claiming that such service calls to chat lines, radio broadcast lines, and similar services aren't included in the telephone plan. So I switch over to my cell phone under the T-Mobile plan, which has unlimited minutes 24/7, 50 states. T-Mobile now has followed AT&T with designating conference calling numbers as out of plan. According to AT&T, their spokesman said that wireless calling is meant for one person to talk to one other person. It's not meant for one person to call one of these lines, and they reserve the right to block calls for a variety of lines. And they've chosen to do that. Singular and T-Mobile appears to be making an artificial distinction here when calling into a conference call. If other cellular operators follow AT&T and T-Mobile's example, their actions could cost and carry heavy implications for future consumer calling freedom. Now we have a distinction for what is a telephone call and what is a conference call. Windows Defender, the anti-malware software built into Windows, is going to start removing badly behaved utility software that is scaring users. And they're going to start doing this in March. The Windows software ecosystem has a large variety of software of dubious merit and claims to detect and diagnose faults. These programs often offer a free version that purports to find problems and a paid version that supposedly will fix the problems. Frequently, the problems detected by the software are either non-existent or misleading and are often blamed for crashes or poor performance. Under Microsoft's new policy, any software that the company deems to be coercive will be a candidate for removal. Coercive elements include software that particularly alarming or exaggerates the risk, software that says the only way to repair the problem is to upgrade, and the software tells the user they must act within a certain limited time, and of course, they ask for payment, so otherwise you can't fix the problem. But so too will apps that require people to take surveys or sign up for newsletters. It's a welcome move. It's a bit late, though. This kind of scaremongering crapware that's been around for a long period of time, bad actors instead prey on the trust and lack of knowledge of Windows users, and they are exploiting fears around security and stability to sell software that, at best, does nothing useful at all. At worst, these programs actually cause problems, deleting required registry entries or removing useful files. The decision to brand such programs as unwanted has been a long time coming. I wonder if these companies are going to start suing Microsoft to say, you took our programs off. That would be quite interesting. Microsoft's first action against such software took place in 2016 when it started penalizing software that either misclassifies files, for example, by deeming desirable system files as junk to be removed, or provided no meaningful information about the errors that it detected. Under the new policy, even software that should happen to accurately diagnose and describe genuine problems will be penalized if it is deemed to be too aggressive. Many of us have Microsoft Office installed, and we may have versions that date back a long time ago. They all work with the existing Windows operating systems. Let me repeat that. Many of us may be using Windows Office that we've installed many years ago and carried it over into more advanced systems. Those pieces of software are valid and they will continue to run. However, what Microsoft wants you to do is each time they want you to upgrade to the latest version of Office. I would bet you that with most people that all the incremental and all the major changes they made to Microsoft Office, for the last 10, 15 years, I would say 90% of you, unless you're in a business environment, haven't used it at all. But you feel like, gee, I need the latest copy of Office to run with the operating system. Well, I'll give you an update of what's happening. Microsoft made an announcement. Microsoft Office 2019 will only work on Windows 10, saying that the app will run on Windows 10. And in a support article for service and support of Windows and Office, Microsoft has revealed you need to upgrade to Windows 10 if you want the latest version of Office without subscribing to the company's Office 365 service. It's a move by Microsoft that really is designed by them to push for businesses that are holding off on Office 365 into subscriptions, as the standalone Office 2019 software will only be supported on Windows 10 and not Windows 7 or Windows 8.1. This, however, won't affect Office for Mac, which is a separate product with a different release schedule. Microsoft is also altering the support lifecycle for Office 2019, so it will receive 5 years of mainstream support and then approximately 2 years of extended support. Office 2019 will be made available in the second half of 2018, and it will include the usual Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and Outlook client apps, alongside with server versions of Exchange, SharePoint, and Skype for Business. That's new. Microsoft is planning to release preview copies of Office 2019 in the middle of 2018, which is the summer, and the software is primarily designed for organizations that aren't using the cloud version of Office 365. Microsoft is also extending its Windows 10 support for enterprise and education customers running certain versions of the operating systems. Windows 10 version 1511, which was the initial release, 1607, which was released in 2016, and 1703 and 1709, released in 2017, will all be supported for another 6 months to help enterprise and educational users move to the latest supported version of Windows 10. For the regular consumer, it doesn't affect you. To streamline Microsoft's overall support, Microsoft is ditching their Windows 10S in favor of a new S mode. Microsoft is switching its approach to Windows 10S and its new version of Windows that's designed to compete with Chrome OS. The software giant originally announced Windows 10S as a dedicated version of Windows for educational customers restricted to running Microsoft Store apps. This S mode will essentially lock down any copy of Windows 10 so it can only run apps from the Microsoft Store, and it does exactly what the dedicated Windows 10S operating system was built to do. Instead of switching to Windows 10 Pro free of charge, 60% of those who do switch reportedly do so within the first 24 hours of owning Windows 10S device, and if they don't switch in a week, then 83% stick with 10S. Windows 10 Home will get a new S mode. That's another announcement by Microsoft. While it's surprising that Windows users are happy sticking to just Microsoft Store apps, it's clear that the company's new strategy will mean even more users could receive devices with S mode enabled. Microsoft is reportedly planning to allow Windows 10 Home users to disable the S mode free of charge, but Windows 10 Pro customers with S mode enabled on their device will be forced to pay $49 to gain access to the full version of Windows 10 Pro. Wait a minute. That sounds like I'm buying for something, I haven't gotten it, and I got to pay more to get it. It's a risky strategy, I believe, and I don't know why they're doing it, but both Microsoft and its various PC partners want to avoid consumer confusion. Well, they've just created it. While the home version appears to be a free switch path, the charge for Pro versions could irritate many users who opt for more premium devices. And of course, it all depends on who the manufacturer is, which is the OEM that shipped the devices with the S mode enabled. Microsoft, my message to you is, just keep it simple. The more you say, the more options you have, the more confusing you are to the public. Is using a cell phone safe? That is a question requiring only a simple yes or no. The answers have turned out to be more confusing as people see what they want to see in the results. The vast majority of cell phone safety research indicates that there's no problem with regular exposure to radio frequency radiation that cell phones use to communicate with towers. But enough studies have shown various health effects that fears of health risk have persisted, even though different studies often identify unrelated risk. The U.S. government's National Toxicology Program designed what could have been a definitive study using long-term exposure of large rodent populations. But even that has caused more problem than it has solved, as the NTP decided to release incomplete results from the study that seemed to find some links to cancer, but the work had problems with weak statistical significance and unexplained deaths in the control animals. The Federal Communications Commission limits how much radio frequency radiation can come out of your cell phone. The Food and Drug Administration can have a say about whether these limits are safe. So the FDA asked the National Toxicology Program, a division within the National Institute of Health, to investigate. Based on the NTP's result, as well as hundreds of other studies, the FDA is still confident that the current limits on cell phone radiation are safe. The study specifically uses 2G and 3G frequencies, not the frequencies used on more advanced 4G and 5G network. Researchers exposed the rodents' entire bodies to the radio waves for more than 9 hours a day for up to 2 years. These exposure levels were much higher than what people would experience. So these findings should not be directly extrapolated to human cell phone usage. And even with these unusually high levels of exposure, the links to cancer were still mostly ambiguous. In fact, the rats exposed to the cell phone radiation actually appeared to live longer than the ones that weren't living, and the FDA said that the agency is assessing the difference could be simply the result of chance. So what do these results in rodents mean for people? Not a whole lot. Even with frequent daily uses by vast majority of adults, we have not seen an increase in events like brain tumors. The FDA statement says, the FDA and the American Cancer Society agreed in an interview with the Associated Press that the evidence for an association between cell phone and cancer is weak, and so far, we have not seen a higher cancer risk in people. There should be a definitive answer of yes or no. Verizon has announced two new data plans that redefine unlimited data and may jumpstart a price war between rival mobile service providers. About a year ago, AT&T and Verizon announced that they would sell unlimited data deals such as those offered by Sprint and T-Mobile. And it looks like they might have regretted it. But none of these carriers have walked back on these unmetered data deals. A third-party study has found that AT&T and Verizon networks have slowed under the stress of new unlimited data subscribers. With these new plans, you have to check very carefully. The wordings on many of the so-called limited plans and unlimited plans with data caps are constantly changing, and you have to review it constantly. In all these cases, you may also want to look at the carrier's prepaid brands and at the cheaper offerings of third-party sellers such as Consumer Cellular, Google Project Fi, Republic Wireless, and Ting, the four highest-ranked services in Consumer Reports' latest reader survey. There's a long, big brouhaha in October when the community discovered that the redesigned calculator app in iOS 11.0 had a semi-serious bug. People noticed that if you typed in 1 plus 2 plus 3 quickly, it would give the incorrect answer. The real problem here was that the fade animation on the operand buttons, that's the plus and the minus, would block user interaction until it's completed. This meant that if you type quickly, the second press of the plus button when typing 1 plus 2 plus 3 would be ignored, but really this happened with any combination of inputs that press the operands quickly. In iOS 11.2, Apple fixed this issue. They removed the animation altogether, making state changes instantaneously. According to Billboard, Best Buy recently told music suppliers of plans to pull all CDs from its stores. Target is expected to follow suit. Even though people are increasingly getting their music from streaming services and vinyl, many were shocked and upset by Best Buy's decision. Best Buy, formerly one of the biggest music merchandisers in the United States, has plans to pull CDs from all of its stores by July 1. Target could be very well the next retailer to follow suit. As Billboard further reported, it was demanding that music suppliers sell the retailer inventory on a consignment basis and pay for unsold inventory. One music manufacturer is leaning towards saying no to this deal. Hey, he could say no to the deal, but he has very limited outlets now. This should come as no big surprise between streaming services like Apple Music and Spotify taking over and vinyl returning to popularity. There doesn't seem to be much of a place for CDs anymore. Well, I don't know. More than 800 million CDs were sold in the United States in 2001, but that number now is about 89 million in 2017. That's about 10%. Even though CD sales have been dropping rapidly for years, people still seem to be quite shocked and upset that no longer be available from Best Buy as they're pulling it from their shelves. Google Fiber is ending its wireless home internet service in Boston, and existing customers in the city will lose their service sometime in the next several months. Google Fiber has had its struggles, but the Boston shutoff doesn't necessarily mean that wireless customers in other cities will also lose service. The service apparently fared pretty poorly in Boston, but the company says it's still doing better in other locations. Google Fiber division cut staff by 9% in 11 cities. Google Fiber got into the wireless business in October of 2016 when it purchased Webpass, which provides speeds ranging from 100 megabits per second to 1 gigabits per second, and mainly serves multi-unit residential buildings and businesses. WebPass started serving Boston in 2015 before it was bought by Google. But WebPass has stopped accepting new customers in Boston and is shutting down its operations there. Google Fiber confirmed that decision when contacted. As with any acquisition, Google said, we spent some time evaluating the WebPass business. As a result of our analysis, we made this decision to wind down the WebPass operations in Boston. We work with customers and partners to minimize disruption, and there will be no immediate impact to their WebPass service. Comcast and RCN offers cable internet service in Boston, and Verizon Fios has started offering service in parts of the city. WebPass continues, however, in 7 other markets. WebPass is still available in Chicago, Denver, Seattle, Oakland, East Bay, San Diego, San Francisco, and Miami. Denver and Seattle were new launches in 2017, and it doesn't appear that any of other pre-merger locations are in danger of shutting down. Google Fiber makes expansion plans for $60 wireless gigabit service. Google Fiber declined to say how many customers it was serving in Boston, and it hasn't provided a specific end date for Boston customers, but says it will take several months to wind down its operation in the city. Nationwide, Google Fiber offers internet service in 20 cities, including Boston for now, via either fiber or wireless connections. The ISP lists 8 cities as potential locations, but it hasn't committed to expanding them. This evening, we have the following feature segments. From Dr. Alfred Poor on wearable and health technologies, he will be covering drug-free treatment for pain, diagnose disease with breath samples, and a new approach to a smart contact lens to measure glucose levels. From the Tech Corner, we'll be covering the evolution from 1G to 5G technologies, and Marty Winston from the Home Automation Front will be talking about if this, then that in home automation, and he has a book review on cyber mercenaries.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider. One of the big hot issues in this country today, and to some extent around the world, is the opioid epidemic. People are abusing, overusing pain medications, and it's creating lots of problems, ruining lives. It is an enormous issue. And as a result, it's really no surprise that many people are rethinking our dependence on medications, having to take a pill to solve whatever problem you might have. We're looking for more non-medicinal solutions to problems, and one of the key ones, of course, is pain. Well, there are a lot of alternative products out there that address some of this, and they have good science behind them. It's not all just sort of smoke and mirrors. One of the big categories is technology called TENS, T-E-N-S, and what that does is sends a slight electrical charge through your skin that stimulates a nerve and actually helps block the pain signals going to your brain. Another kind of product that's out there is a thing called Actipatch, A-C-T-I-P-A-T-C-H, Actipatch. It uses a totally different kind of non-chemical technology to address pain. What it has is a circular loop that is used to transmit electromagnetic pulses. What you do is you put the circle around the area of your body where the pain is, and the electromagnetic pulses will then disrupt the pain sensors in that part of your body. It doesn't affect your whole body like TENS does, and there's no direct contact with electrodes to your skin, so it's not sending electrical current into your skin the way of TENS does. So there's no tingling, and apparently it's safe to wear for hours at a time. The company just today released the results of a double-blind test that they did. They had two groups. One received a placebo, in other words, a device that wasn't turned on, and the other ones received the pain-canceling device. And the researchers who were doing the testing didn't know who was getting which one. So that's why they call it double blind. And the results came back clearly showing that those who had the device that was working had a reduction in pain. Those who didn't have the device showed much less pain reduction. So there's some evidence that this thing works. The interesting thing is that it's available over the counter, cleared by the FDA for sale at retail. It looks like it works and looks like it can provide a viable alternative for some people to taking pain medication. If you're a fan of Star Trek, then you remember the device that Dr. McCoy had that he could just wave over your body and it would find what's wrong. It could diagnose you with a non-invasive, no-contact kind of procedure. Well, this is something that we're looking for in the current reality. And one of the most intriguing ways of diagnosing potential disease is through breath samples. Now, your breath goes down into your lungs, which gets exposed to many of the chemicals that are in your body, natural or otherwise. And the key is sampling that breath and finding those tiny, tiny amounts of the different chemicals. Well, there's a company that has created a handheld device that is as good as what we would call the gold standard analysis of gas samples. The way it works is it sends an electrical charge through the sample, and this causes the ions, the different chemicals, to actually migrate, and so that the ions of the same chemical will cluster together at different points within the sensors, and then those can be measured and identified and so forth. It's a company called BreathTech Biomedical from Vancouver in Canada. The interesting thing about this, they've run tests against results from a gas spectrometer, which is the gold standard. That's the lab equipment that you would use for this kind of analysis. And they've discovered that the results from their device correlate very well with the results of the large formal gas spectrometer. So if this works out, if they can develop this product and turn it into an affordable, reliable device, it could transform how we test for different kinds of diseases, possibly even cancer, simply by having a patient blow into this device and having it sample their breath, looking for the biomarkers that would indicate different kinds of disease. Another area where we are looking for better ways to sample and identify biomarker levels within the body is diabetes. It's a worldwide epidemic. It costs billions of dollars a year in healthcare costs and has complications that ruin people's lives that can even be fatal. And so anything we can do to improve the treatment and maintenance of diabetes could be a huge savings for everybody. We've heard over the years a number of people who've been trying to develop a way to measure your glucose level based on your tears rather than having to sample your blood. And one of the ways that they've been going about this is to actually create a smart contact lens that could measure glucose levels and report them so you wouldn't have to do a finger stick in order to measure the blood sugar level. A team of Korean researchers at two universities there have been working on the problem. Some of the original attempts ran into difficulty because they had to use relatively large and rigid semiconductor components that would make up the sensors, the wireless transmitters, and so forth. And these would block vision. It would make the contact lens rigid. It would create hard spots and basically was not a good solution. Well, these researchers have come up with a way to use nanostructured material to create transparent conductors and semiconductor components for the sensors and the wireless transmitters and all. These are flexible, they're stretchable, and so they've been able to incorporate them into a soft contact lens. It doesn't obscure vision and is much more comfortable to wear. Now, we've got a long way to go before this becomes a real product, but it would be great if in the future monitoring your glucose levels would be as simple as just sticking a contact lens in your eye. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Mobile 5G service with Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile, all announcing plans to roll out the faster network tech within the next couple of years. Sprint already has plans to launch its own 5G network in 2019. Sprint is working with Qualcomm to launch the first truly mobile 5G network in the United States by the first half of 2019. This moves Sprint's original plans up a bit in comparison to AT&T plans to launch 5G service in 12 cities this year, while Verizon has plans to do so in the second half of 2018. T-Mobile doesn't plan to roll out its own 5G service out until 2020. It is reported that Sprint will have to increase prices, though, from $70 to $80 for unlimited 5G data, which would bring it more in line with its competitors. 2G puts telephones in our pocket. 3G and 4G put the internet in our pocket, and 5G will put the world in our pocket. Last year, the telecom companies began to roll out the very basic concepts of a 5G network. It appears that AT&T and Verizon are gearing up to piecemeal limited 5G networks this year, much like Verizon's 2010 rollout of 4G. AT&T is reported to begin selling portable hotspots that would bring mobile 5G to 12 select cities. On the other hand, T-Mobile is marking their own plans to launch a full network by 2020. What this all means is that they're all saying they'll have 5G, but not the full implementation of it, and just by having piecemeal pieces of it, they say they have a 5G network. Well, it's clear that everyone wants to have a 5G network in the next few years, that we don't mix 5G piecemeal network with what 5G network should be. The main proponent of these changes is speed, and that can be interpreted in a few different ways because there's really no set standard on what the speeds are. Well, there are standards, but there are very wide, there's a wide limit from the lowest to the highest. Firstly, 5G proposes the theoretical speed from up to 10 gigabits per second, while 4G claims a top speed of 300 megabits per second. 4G, however, averages about 40 to 50 megabits per second, so it's likely that 5G will have the same sort of limitations. But a 5G revolution will enable streaming services of 4K content, as that is recommended to stream at roughly 25 megabits per second, so you don't get freeze frames. It could be so fast that downloading would simply be better just, well, downloading it first. Secondly, the 5G spectrum will allow a much wider spectrum of devices to be connected. Every manufacturer is building connected products with a foundation that their low-powered, low-bandwidth of Internet of Things devices will live permanently in the 5G network. That means security cameras, self-driving cars, drones, smartwatches, and even cities could be accessible from anywhere in the world, well, thanks to massive 5G bandwidth. T-Mobile does bring in a few interesting points. Their claims are that companies would do anything to say they have the first 5G network. Well, it's probably right, but there will be a lot of miscommunication about what 5G is until we actually have a full nationwide network. Well, what does G stand for? It stands for generation, as in the next generation of wireless technologies. Each generation is supposed to be faster, more secure, and more reliable. The reliability factor is the hardest thing to overcome. The reliability factor is the hardest obstacle to overcome. By the way, the first generation was analog. The second generation was a major change from analog to digital. 2G, or the second generation, was a major jump when wireless networks went from analog to digital. 3G came along, which offered faster data transfer speed, at least 200 kilobits per second for multimedia use, and was a long-time standard for wireless transmission. Although the talk is 5G, it's still a challenge to get true 4G today, which promises upwards of 1 gigabit per second transfer rate. True 4G on a widespread basis may not be available until the next generation arrives, called 5G. Boy, is it confusing. Each of the generations has standards that must be met. Each of the generations has standards that must be met to officially use the G terminology. The standards themselves are quite confusing, as the advertisers sure know how to manipulate them. That's where we get the LTE in there. 1G, a term never really used because it was the first generation of cell phone technology. Simple phone calls were all it was able to do. 2G, the second generation of cell phone transmission. A few more features were added to the menu, such as simple text messaging. Well, what was in 3G standard? This generation set the standards for most of the wireless technology we have come to know, that we have come to know and love. Web browsing, email, video downloading, picture sharing, and other smartphone technology were introduced in the third generation. 3G should be capable of handling around 2 megabits per second. 4G, the speed and standard of this technology of wireless, needs to be at least 100 megabits per second, up to 1 gigabits per second to pass as 4G. It also needs to share the network resources to support more simultaneous connections on the cell. As it develops, 4G could surpass the speed of the average wireless broadband home internet connection. However, few devices are capable of full throttle when the technology was first released. Coverage of true 4G was limited to large metropolitan area. Outside of the covered area, 4G phones regressed to 3G standards. When metropolitan areas outside the covered areas, check. When 4G first became available, it was simply a little faster than 3G. 4G is not the same as 4G LTE, which is very close to meeting the criteria of the standards. The major wireless networks were not actually lying to anyone when 4G was first rolled out. They simply stretched the truth a bit. A 4G phone had to comply with the standards, but finding the network resources to fulfill the true standards was difficult. You were buying 4G-capable devices before the networks were capable of delivering true 4G to the device. Your brain knows that 4G is faster than 3G, so you pay the price for the extra speed. Marketing 101. The same will probably be true when 5G hits the market. 4G LTE is long-term evolution, and of course LTE sounds better. This is a buzzword and a version of 4G that is the latest advertised technology, and it gets closer to the speed needed to meet the standards of 1 gigabyte. When you start hearing about LTE Advanced, then we will be talking about true fourth generation wireless technologies, because they are the only two formats realized by the International Telecommunications Union as true 4G at this time. But forget about that, because 5G is coming soon to the phone near you. Then there's, well, you get this, then there is XLTE, which is a bandwidth charger with minimum of double the bandwidth of 4G LTE and is available anywhere the AWS spectrum is initiated. Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint have all advanced to the LTE technology, with each carrier adding their own combination of wireless technologies, including XLTE, to enhance the spectrum. 5G, we can expect that new technology to be fully rolled out around 2020. Well, that's about 2 years away. It seems a long way away, but time flies, and so will 5G at speeds 1 to 10 gigabits. But this is not all about cell phones. Juxtapose the always connected PC and you'll probably see a speed up in the schedule for implementation. The always connected PC is a new kind of PC that can run all day with the improved battery life and stay constantly connected to the internet with a Qualcomm LTE modem inside, no matter where the user may roam. PCs have already been introduced to always be on.
When I started thinking about my cybernetic house, the world was a lot simpler. And that's historically true. That's accurate in the technology. I'll give you some touch points in a minute. But I want to start with how decisions are made, decision points. And the thing that was available to me and to others and in those early days is a thing online called IFTTT, which stands for If This, Then That. It's a classic programming approach to using the status of one or more elements to determine whether or not to command some outcome. It's also an online utility with which many home automation products are compatible. So if you, the sensor says this temperature, turn on this fan, do this, do that, its rule sets stay pretty simple, with most activities determined by some binary on versus off value, or by the relationship of a current reading to a predetermined or user-determined threshold reading. Is it over-freezing? Is it under-freezing? It could be that simple. It's built to be easy, not elegant. Our real-life decision points, on the other hand, tend to be considerably more nuanced. We consider many factors, and we weight them. We ascribe weights to each factor, continually shifting our perception of their values. Here's an example. You see a child doing something dangerous. How many factors do you instantly consider in making an immediate response? And how many in determining your very next step? And then how many options do you consider among possible other next steps? The only thing we can identify today as anything close to absolute is that the potential for missing significant factors rises with the impact of consequences of the outcome of the decision. The more important the outcome of the decision, the more difficult the decision. That's been around forever. Decision points may not be as simple as binary logic or threshold events, but they are nonetheless points requiring immediate evaluation and immediate action. One approach to that is to deal with weighted factors as algorithms and to let them interact, but that's far more complex than I'm prepared to try to program in this decade. Now, is it a time to think or a time to act? That's one of the decision points. Is it a time to think or a time to act? You know, it's kind of odd. We now apply that to a machine and not just to people. It's very reminiscent of a major theme in Shakespeare's plays, expressed quite well in Hamlet when he was trying to decide when to be a doer, when to be a thinker, and getting it wrong just about every time. He said, "The time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right." Decision points, action, inaction, thinking, doing, decision points. Now, our decision points are easily warped, easily drawn astray, easily distracted. And one of the major distractions, and one that is especially dangerous, is convenience. I hope to get you thinking of convenience as cheese in a mousetrap. The cheese a mouse sees, or the wiggle of a worm to a fish, are examples of things that seem almost irresistibly attractive in stories that don't end happily for mice or fish. Our recent research into cyber criminals, I'll tell you more about that in a moment, gives us an increasingly trepidatious outlook into convenience as a pre-existing element in their prey ecosystem. That's meaning their food chain. Consider the extent to which striving for convenience is driving home automation installations on the consumer side and driving IIoT, Industrial Internet of Things, among manufacturing, production, and other automation control systems. On the consumer side, the added automation products bring opportunities for hacking, for disruption, for ransomware, for theft of goods, for identity theft. The risks for IIoT may prove greater and even more consequential. These are not dangers for which insurance is available to users, in part because there's no actuarial data to indicate any limitation to the potential for damage. Any effort to get the automation vendors or sources to indemnify, let alone make whole, faces the same totally unreadable risk pool. Even worse, while IIoT is new and system configurations vary widely, it is, through growth, quickly losing its unpredictability. If the bad guys decide, for whatever reason, the first reason is usually money, and ransomware has become popular among them as a first exploit. If the bad guys ever decide to go after IIoT control systems, it could mean overriding pressure relief valves to destroy water or sewage utilities or manufacturing plants. And in manufacturing plants, there's a potential for combustion or explosion. On the consumer side, we already saw a ransomware payment when Russian hackers took control of a smart thermostat. What will happen in an era of autonomous cars and automated drone deliveries? getting into systems is not as hard as we might hope. And zero day, now that means never before deployed, zero day vulnerabilities are actively and continually for sale on the dark web. Worse, these are no longer just IT-directed exploits. They're also available for industrial control systems. Today, those hackers are seeking to harvest profits, not to do harm. But there is absolutely nothing to prevent greed from giving way to malice as a prime motivator. I picked up some additional information about this, really scary too, in a book that I just reviewed for the News Tips Bulletin called Cyber Mercenaries, The State, Hackers, and Power by Moorer of Cambridge University Press. Remember James Bond? The fictional James Bond claimed to work for international exports. That was his cover. He really worked for MI6. He was a spy. He conducted otherwise criminal acts, but did them on behalf of an authorizing government agency. He was a licensed criminal, a licensed assassin, licensed to kill. The landscape for defensive to offensive cyber activities is already far more complex and nuanced than the world of James Bond. In Cyber Mercenaries, there's a compelling, complacency-wrenching look into otherwise imperceptible shapes and changes in the cyber battlefield. Mercenaries and other proxies are significant players. One emerging conflict, in fact, is between private businesses seeking revenge against cyber attacks and governments wanting less clutter on this new battlefield. No book review can do justice to the significant, well-researched information and analysis within the book. And note that I'm about 20 miles away from a key U.S. military and security center for cyber operations, which is at the moment hallmarked by extraordinary construction activities as it more than triples in size. Now, Cyber Mercenaries is not based on speculation, not based on opinion. It is based on observations of the non-land, non-sea, non-air, and non-space proscribed battlegrounds of worldwide cyber operations. It's the new battlefield where activities only occasionally penetrate into public news headlines. It's scary, and I'm happy to say that our forces are among the best in the world, according to what I've read in Cyber Mercenaries, which is not built to raise anybody's confidence. And that's a good thing, given how expert the hackers are at dangling convenience in front of us to gain our trust, to gain access, to gain attack venues that they can exploit right now for greed, maybe eventually for malice. And in part, that's because we like the convenience of simple decision point thinking built around if this, then that. Nothing more complicated. If this, then that. And when those readings go to the cloud, and as you know, if Alexa can do it, Alexi can do it. When those readings go to the cloud and you establish the patterns of life at your home, at your office, at your factory, wherever, you've written the book by which the bad guys can come and take full advantage of you. That's a good reason to lock yourself into your cyber house, isn't it? And as Hank always says, back up, back up, back up. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Tour the New World of Augmented Reality Thursday, February 8, 2018 at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 405 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have a meeting on Friday, February the 9th, 2018 at 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane. Meeting is at the auditorium of the Harry S. Schur Hall. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a meeting presentation on online tools Friday, February the 16th at 8 p.m. They'll meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on voice-operated assistance Thursday, February the 22nd, 2018, and the meeting time is at 6:45 p.m. They will meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group will have a meeting on Tuesday, February the 27th, 2018, at 7 p.m. at Mercer County Library, located at Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting Thursday, March the 1st, 2018, at 7 p.m. They meet at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. The User Club meetings, by the way, are free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there. And a big festival is coming up. TCF 2018, the 43rd Annual Computer Festival. The theme of the festival is wearable technologies. The Trenton Computer Festival is an annual educational event with speakers, forums, and user group meetings, and an indoor flea market. Saturday, March the 17th, 2018, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the College of New Jersey. The website is tcf-nj.org for more information. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI, FM 99.5 New York on the radio and on WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. And in this crazy weather we have, stay safe, stay healthy, until we meet again, same time, same station, next week. Thank you.